Bitcoin. You know, that alternative currency that's designed to help people and businesses exchange money without banks. It closed Friday at its highest level ever, $2,288. The technology behind Bitcoin is something called blockchain. And it promises, and although their history is replete with broken promises, it promises to significantly affect people in a wide range of careers, from entrepreneurs to financial planners to even Uber drivers. I read an article that fleshes all this out in Psychology Today. The author even wonders whether blockchain is going to enable us to bypass middlemen such as Uber, Airbnb, eBay, and even the Goliath Amazon. What he is referred to as, or I'm referring to, I guess, as the sharing economy on steroids. The author of that article is with me in the studio. He is Moses Ma. He's a partner in Future Lab Consulting. It's a strategic consulting firm that also runs a boutique high-tech venture accelerator in San Francisco. That means he takes these startups and helps them grow faster. There's startups in enterprise software, digital media, other technologies. So the guy knows tech. He's also created two of the world's best-selling computer games. He took an unfunded software startup and he built it into the 97th largest, 7th fastest growing, and 11th most profitable in the country. He's a Caltech grad in physics, been featured in Time, New York Times, etc. Moses Ma, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good. So, first, in language not for Caltech people, but language is easy enough for a reasonably intelligent 6th grader to understand, what's blockchain?
Okay, so first I'll use my term, which is a consensually validated multi-party database.
Boy, yeah, yeah. Nobody knows what that is. Hell of a 6th grader.
Yeah. So the way to explain it is much easier. Suppose we're in a quiet room and I give you $5.
Right.
We can go outside and say, you never give me any money, and I couldn't prove it.
Right.
But if we have 50 people in the room that witness it, then it's probably for sure that I gave you the money. They could attest to that. Mm-hmm. That's all a blockchain is.
It's a high-tech receipt.
It's a high-tech receipt that's validated by 50 people in the room who are called miners.
Okay. Now, but these are, of course, not people. We're talking about digital. How do they digitally prove that you made the payment?
Well, there are actually many ways of doing that now. So the first way, in the Bitcoin, they used a cryptographic glue that did that. So they would allow, when you had a majority of the miners or the people doing this cryptographic analysis, they said it's a real transaction, that you would believe it. But that led to something called the 51% hack. So if you had 26 people in the room and you bribed them, you could actually say whatever happened was what you said. The new ways of doing it have to do with proof of stake. You put up a deposit to prove what you're saying. Another way is Intel has something called proof of elapsed time so that the trust is built into the chipset itself. And the easiest way is called N of M, which means like 7 of 10 people have to agree. So you can actually vary that.
So there's no real people, though. So, you know, it's digitally verifying that you made it. It's a digital receipt. So now back to our 6th grader. What is the proof that I paid you $5 or you paid me $5?
Well, again, it's consensually validated. So the only proof is that when the people represented by their computers that are doing this cryptographic analysis say that you did it. So it's still a consensus agreement that
there happened. There are people. You're using the keyboard, you're using people. Are there people?
There are people always running these things, right? So, for example, China actually runs, maybe 40% of the mining operations. So if the government took them over, everyone's afraid that they'll do a 51% hack.
So what I'm understanding, it sounds like you would need zillions of these arbiters to say, yes, transaction. I mean, I thought this was all automated. So, I mean, I read this thing that there was this company that now makes a million transactions per second. Why do we need all these people? Are there people involved, or am I missing something?
Yeah, so the way that the current blockchains work, you have a lot of people agreeing that transaction actually happened. So you consensually agree on what happened. So that's all it is. If you took all those people out and just had one person doing it, you'd have to trust that person.
But how many? It seems like you would need zillions of people to verify these zillions of transactions. What am I not understanding?
No, you don't need a zillion. You actually just need the number of miners, which is less than 1,000, I think.
But I thought we were talking about basically the notion is that this would eliminate the need for banks.
Yes,
you know, and that this, you know, and that there were, this was somehow eliminating the middleman. Isn't, aren't you? If it's involving people, then aren't you essentially creating some kind of a another middleman? And if you're not requiring people, then I mean, I don't understand.
Well, the computers that are doing the work are owned by people, and those people could program those computers in different ways so that they agree in a certain way. So what you want is, if you get the majority of them to agree on something and they're all unrelated, then you have a pretty good chance that it's a valid transaction.
I'm going to leave aside this because I can't begin to contemplate the scalability of that with the, you know, with the, if we're talking about, you know, replacing middlemen like banks and Uber and whatever. But let's, you know, you're not the only person to say that this offers potential for changing careers for many people, and that's what the show has to focus on. So let's get real concrete. Let's say I run a small business and I'm thinking about the KLW listenership. Let's say I'm an acupuncturist, right? How can blockchain either today or in the foreseeable future change my career, the way I run my small business?
Okay, the first thing I have to tell you is that no one knows for sure exactly how. It's like the early days of the internet. You can't really predict it. In fact, if you look at the before the internet, almost no futurist predicted the internet.
True.
Right? So right now we're at this, you know, they call it the singularity, but it's going to be very difficult to predict. Nevertheless, we can try, right? So let's first start with some of the wacky ideas people have come up with. Some people are using it now to help refugees. It's like a refugee from a certain country may go to a refugee camp. They don't want anyone to know who they are, because if someone gets hold of that list, the government back home may go hunt down their family and hurt them. So how do you verify their identity without knowing, you know, who they are? How can you do that? So that's called decentralized trust or sovereign identity. So the blockchain solves these kind of problems. You can actually track human trafficking and kind of deal with that. You can detect counterfeit goods. You can change the music industry. You can. There's a new startup that's detecting fake news.
Okay, let's unpack this, because we're done. So. Back to the acupuncturist thing for a moment.
Sure.
You had talked about, you know, that in our preparation for the show, you talked about that one of the more logical ways in which blockchain is going to be used in the short term is for contracts, for purchasing, and for medical records. Can you unpack that for us?
Sure. So a small business, we believe, will have three kinds of benefits. One is in cost reduction. So you could do things like smart contracts with a blockchain, and you could do things, they call them triple entry accounting. So instead of double entry, it's like both sides are automatically audited. So that means you hire less accountants and attorneys to run your business, so it's reducing your costs. The second thing it does is you can actually simplify your supply chain. So the stuff you're buying to make your good to sell, you could take all the fat and the friction out of it so that it actually becomes cheaper.
How would there be less friction? Let's say I am an acupuncturist and I want to buy, oh, I don't know, cover sheets to cover my bed, the acupuncture bed. Right now I could go certainly to Amazon and I see tons of vendors. It's this friction-free, it's a three-click thing, including tons of enormous numbers of reviews.
Yes.
Where does blockchain add value to this?
So one thing is that Amazon owns that list of vendors, so you have to pay them their percentage for doing that. Imagine there was something like Amazon, except on a blockchain, that's owned by everybody. So there's no more middleman for that.
But if you're involving people in this blockchain, don't they have to get paid too?
Well, the people setting up a blockchain, the blockchain is actually supported by all the people out there, sort of like, you know, a music sharing system or a file sharing system like BitTorrent. It's actually supported by the whole world, so it's part of the commons.
So there's no money. So in other words, that's where the job killer, essentially, is that right? If everybody's volunteering, it's like, you know, I'm a musician and I don't get any money anymore because everybody's pirating the music and so everything is volunteer now. Or journalism, you know, everything is considered free, so we're citizen journalists. So is this just really a big job killer? Is everybody simply volunteering to screw the banks? Is that fair?
Yes. Bitcoin is sort of like Skype for money, right? So it is true that the first phase of the digital revolution, it's cost reduction. But the second phase has to do with improving the quality of the transactions. So what will end up happening is For example, let's take digital music. Right now, you're not making any money. In fact, right. I think if you had a gold album before, you made an average of like $45,000. And now, if you're streaming, it's like $45
right.
that you make for a million listens. So that's changed. But if you look at Imogen Heap, who's a British rock musician, so she's started a blockchain startup called Mycelia, which is an ecosystem where she could publish her music. And not only the music, if you agree to participate in her ecosystem, you get access to her original tracks and to, you know, cuts, and then you can remix her music and then automatically pay her a percentage of your remix. So everyone gets paid directly. So yes, it's taking out the middleman, but if you do them right, it actually will benefit the content creator. So let me give you a really good example. The French Revolution. After the French Revolution, they decided that intellectual property is owned by the people. So they invalidated IP rights for copyright. Within a couple of years, it collapsed the entire publishing industry. And they said, you know, we can't do this anymore. We have to pay the content creators. Otherwise, they're not going to create. So they actually produced what we know today as copyright law, saying, okay, for the lifetime of the artist, we pay this amount, a royalty. But after that, it becomes public domain. So that was the grand bargain. And that's what's happening now, is we're figuring out the how the blockchain, we're actually making history and negotiating grand bargains around blockchains to figure out what should the musician be paid and what should distribution pay, what should marketing be paid. So all of this is being worked out. But I believe that in the long run, it's actually going to work out for everyone.
Hmm. So I'm trying to think of this. So I've had 350,000 views of my YouTube videos.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get a penny. I'm not big enough to get advertising revenue, and it's direct. I've got no real middleman other than that I post it for free with no costs on YouTube or Vimeo or whatever. So if I were to get a contract with a label, the label's going to I mean, how would I'm not understanding how I'm going to really make more money.
I think what you have to do is you have to add value to your content in order to monetize it.
But if I do, let's say, I mean, if I say, fine, I'm going to give you access to all of my videos and you can edit them and whatever and pay me. I could do that, you know, by taking on PayPal or Amazon. I'm not seeing anything other than that you're replacing the employees of PayPal and Google and, you know, everybody with volunteers. So
yes, that's exactly what's happening.
So isn't that the ultimate job? We're going to live in a, you know, people. So all those people who were relying on income to afford toilet paper now are not going to have their jobs.
It will benefit the creators of content and materials. It will disintermediate all the middlemen in the way and the back office processing.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I'm talking with Moses Ma about something called blockchain. It is an attempt, now as I'm understanding it better, it's an attempt really to get rid of all middlemen and replace them with volunteers. And it has implications, obviously, for work, for good and for bad. So let's take Uber. You know, you had written that. Like, if I'm an Uber driver, how's blockchain going to affect me for better or worse?
Well, you know, that's already happening. There's a startup called Arcade City. They've got about 3,000 drivers signed up. What they did is they replaced Uber. So you can actually just go. And Uber makes, you know, about 30% profit. So they're going to take that out of the equation so you can get a ride cheaper. The other thing they're doing is Uber price sets for everybody. So what they're going to do is allow every driver to bid, which means it could be a race to the bottom.
Yeah,
but then if your reputation is good, it would go up. If you have if you're like an incredibly entertaining driver and you have reviews of that, people are going to say, oh, I want him.
Incredible, though, is not a societal answer. So what I'm picturing is this. In general, most people just want somebody who's going to show up on time and get them where they want on time without, you know, that's it. And so there's a lot of lonely people in this world who is, you know, sitting around the house and bored, and they just like some company. Sometimes they would hire a hooker. Sometimes they'd go to a bar and buy some person a drink. And so they're willing to pay for company. So I picture these Uber drivers who are simply looking for company. They're going to, you know, it's going to be a race to the bottom. Hey, I'm willing to pay you to you know, would you please let me drive you? I'll pay you $5. I mean, is this not a race to the bottom for every driver?
Well, the free market may look like a race to the bottom, but
yeah.
It isn't.
Tell me more.
There's a spread, right? The people who are like really interested in making rent, yes, they'll discount, but then they'll be used up, and then during periods when there are a lot of people trying to get to the airport, the price will go up. The free market has always worked. So, you know, if you believe in the free market, it should work. And what Arcade City is doing is creating a freer market.
I don't know. Part of me does really believe in the free market, that in the end, the greatest good does accrue through the rewards and incentives. But I also see that the free market, you know, people were born smarter, with more better parents, in better neighborhoods, and they're going to win. And there's relatively few of those. And in a free open market, like I'm a career counselor, and I look at the job market, and I see in an environment where we have more of a free market, because an employer can place an ad on just, you know, for next to nothing on Indeed and Craigslist and or LinkedIn, and they're going to get hundreds and hundreds of applicants. So they can usually get somebody for nothing to make it an internship, a volunteer position, or pay them crap. You know, and because so much work product can be done from Azerbaijan to Zambia, they can hire somebody in Ouagadougou, Upper Volta, who's willing to work for 15 cents an hour or not, or somebody who's bored, who wants to work. I mean, isn't capitalism in some sense, and I know there's huge disadvantages to socialism, but is this not the problem of humankind that we can't solve, whether through capitalism or socialism? But certainly taking away all these jobs, which it sounds like this is going to do, is going to hurt humankind.
Let me give you a counterpoint. My niece has a PhD in data science, so the offering, she's making like $150,000.
Of course
now.
She is.
Yeah. So the answer is get smarter. You have to learn. You have to be educated. It's a difficult solution, but that's what's happening.
That's dreaming. There are not that many people who can get a PhD. And frankly, as a woman today, that gives her additional strength in the job market. A PhD in data science, the number one most in-demand field, the highest level degree, and a woman. And you're using her as an example. There's 7.4 billion people on the planet. That's hardly a solution.
So let me give you another example. If you go back to 1905, what was the land speed record?
Probably 30 miles an hour.
59 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And it was a daredevil driver who did it. And a few years later, Congress was discussing what the maximum speed should be for the U.S. And a couple of doctors came in and said that it should be 10 miles an hour, because if you drive at 20 miles an hour, you will actually go insane, because the human being wasn't ready to do that. Mm-hmm. So if you look today, everybody can drive 60 miles an hour without putting on makeup or drinking coffee. People change. People get smarter. If you look at the number of PhDs granted, 90% of all the scientists who have ever lived are alive today. The number of patents being granted are greater. The productivity is actually going up. So there is an evolution in human knowledge and intelligence, and it's happening in front of us. So if you look at the world in India and in China, China's building 4,000 universities that give PhDs away. So they know where the future is. And America should be following suit and then backing up its colleges to improve education and get more PhDs. One thing I told the National Science Foundation is that we should start teaching quantum physics in high school to prepare people for the quantum computing revolution.
I think your fallacy is the egalitarian fallacy. You know, I have a PhD too, so I've spent a lot of time from Berkeley, and I taught there, so I've hung around some smart people. But I've also, in my super liberal days, I quit a research fellowship at the Rockefeller University to teach in the inner city. And I got to see up close and personal for a year. I didn't just do it for 5 minutes. I did it for 4 years. I got to see up close and personal what the wider range of humankind is like. And I think we in the, quote, intelligentsia are completely out of touch with the full distribution of the 7.4 billion people on the planet. I'm really worried about that. And I think what I want to do is I want to go to the phones. I think I'm going to give my listeners a chance to ask you a question. So we're talking about this thing called blockchain, which is the essentially a replacement of some of the more, if you will, really successful examples of capitalism. That is the banks, Uber, Airbnb, eBay, Amazon, so that it's so that the work that they're doing as the middlemen, and we're not even talking about marketing here, which is a whole other thing. How is a musician going to market? They hire the label to market them and do this sophisticated marketing and have spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to market their music. You know, how is Joe Schmuck, who's a musician, and his volunteer you know, blockchain people. How are they going to get the word out about his magnificent music? I don't get it.
Let's before we take a call, let's talk about that acupuncturist again. I'll give you an example.
Go.
So small businesses, I think they can reduce costs. They can find easier ways to get investment. You can do, you know, initial coin offerings. You could even...
How is that different than Kickstarter?
It is Kickstarter, but it's a little bit better because you can add a reputation manager into it. And so it's essentially Kickstarter, except if you look at the recent ICOs, they've raised...
What's an ICO? I don't know what that means.
Initial coin offering. Their blockchain startups are raising money by selling Bitcoin. And they've raised, let's see, Gnosis was the most recent one. They raised $5.5 million in 15 minutes.
Wow.
So there's a lot of money in the in this area. Another thing you can do is you can actually do invoice factoring.
What's factoring?
Factoring is when you borrow money against your receivables. So you can actually...
Borrowing money against your receivables. So receivables are... That's the money that's owed. There's a lot of money owed you, and
you don't get
the money, and so you go to this bank or whatever, and they'll say, well, we know you're going to get this money, so we're going to lend you some money.
Exactly. Exactly. So there's a company called Fluent, and they do something called invoice tokenization. A token or is a coin. And that's essentially preventing what I call springtime for Hitler. You know, the
explain all that. I don't get
okay, so you know that stage movie, show movie,
the producers.
So Springtime for Hitler was their play, and their idea was, we'll just sell shares to everybody, and when it fails, no one will know that we oversold it. Okay, that's what the blockchain does. It prevents double spending or triple spending of your equity. So you can actually raise the money, and you can go to the blockchain and say, oh yeah, they didn't, you know, oversell the rights to the show. So they're doing that with invoices because you could theoretically sell your invoice to several people and they wouldn't know because there's no way of tracking them definitively through a system. So the blockchain gives you that. Everyone will know that's the place that I'm putting my invoices. And then you can actually enable this new method of financing companies. The third one is what I call marketization. So to explain that, let me talk about the acupuncturist. So the acupuncturist would be able to, you know, first, let's assume we have a blockchain that's like the healthcare records blockchain, except it's for alternative healthcare. So it's connected to, but it's on the side of the medical one. And in this blockchain, your patient will connect his smartwatch to it. You could see how many steps they've walked, if they've gone to a physical therapist, or if they're actually adhering to the treatment program. The other thing you could do with that blockchain is you could look for negative interactions between herbs and drugs, which is actually interesting, right?
Why is there a need for a separate? I mean, nobody could argue against electronic medical records. Anything that, you know, where you know, so you don't have to have repeated testing or whatever. Why does it need to be an alternative one that's run by volunteers or whatever this thing is? Why wouldn't, I mean, Kaiser is certainly in the forefront of this, where you've got on a chip that's either embedded in you or on a card, you know, all of your tests, all the videos of your procedures, so they see what everything's... is it any more different? Why do we need something on the side? Why does it need to be volunteers? Why is not the incentive of capitalism that you're so extolling, which is what's driving the creation of these electronic medical record systems, which cost millions of dollars to integrate so that they work in, you know, in everything from CPMC to Kaiser? What is the need for blockchain here?
So, first of all, I believe that all of the medical records will be put on blockchains, but it's going to be driven by insurance companies and healthcare companies. So I don't think they're going to allow people onto that blockchain who aren't part of that ecosystem. So if it's a treatment you can't get insurance reimbursement for, it probably you have to be on a separate blockchain that connects to it. That's my belief about what will happen. But the point here is this, is that... it would be useful to connect them because we want to see what the negative interactions of herbs and drugs would be, and that's one way to do it. The other thing you can do is, suppose the acupuncturist wanted to reorder some more Dong Quai or ginseng. Right now, they would go to Amazon or wherever or to their distributor and say that. But if it's on a blockchain, everybody who buys and sells herbs is on that blockchain. You could marketize that blockchain. Somebody could write an app that says, oh, before you order, let me find someone else who sells it cheaper. And that's not a service that's done for you automatically by Amazon. You actually have to go there and look for one. But the thing is, if to have an agent that does that would be an additional app. That means some acupuncturist wrote an app on this thing called a blockchain. And a blockchain is like an app store for business applications. So it simplifies that process because all the data is kind of the same.
I think I need help here for my listeners because this is all beyond me. Because, I mean, I can't think of anything easier in my entire life than going than have a one-stop shop. I go to Amazon, I search on whatever term I want, and instantly I get 50 vendors who are telling me that, and it's listed in order of price, including shipping, as well as an enormous database of the user reviews as to how good the vendor is. I'm not understanding this, and create a duplicate of that to avoid Amazon. I'm not understanding the benefit to anybody.
Well, Amazon's still charging a percentage, right?
So yeah, so they charge a percent, the 1%, 2%, whatever.
We'll see what happens, but my belief is that in the long run, people will gravitate to things that reduce the margin a little bit.
Help me, dear listeners. Okay, I already have calls on, so I'm not even going to give out the phone number. Let's go to Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and my guest, Mosen Ma, a guy who knows something about blockchain and Bitcoin and all of that. What? Help me out here. You have a question or comment for my guest, Moses Ma? Hi, you're there. You're on the line.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, my name is David, and thank you for the show. Your caller is absolutely brilliant, and you've done a great job. I really want to kind of continue your point for just a moment, that I feel that technologies like this are great and they're very efficient for the economy, but what's really sorely lacking is how they don't address an inclusion of everyone, really.
That's what I was asking about.
Really,
yeah.
Really not what society needs. In a way, it's more technology, it's more wealth concentration, it's more efficiency for a few. It's not really inclusive. What we need is technologies to help the masses, like you were talking about, the average person at this point.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the call. Why don't you take, so let's kind of end this I want you to be now not a techno-optimist, not a techno-pessimist. I want you to be a statesman. And you're not here to advocate for blockchain or for a techno-optimism or whatever, but you're here to step back from your life and think, okay, let's look at blockchain and technologies like this. To what extent will it benefit humankind versus, as the caller was saying, that small percentage of developers who are brilliant, the people who are rich enough to afford to work as a volunteer on blockchain, to what extent will it benefit consumers, small businesses? How will it affect banks, insurance companies? Be a statesman. What is your best take on this?
So, first of all, it's a great question. What I need to explain to you is that technology comes in waves. So the first generation of technology, you know, is dominated by large banks and it's to concentrate wealth. But when you get to the second and third generation, the second generation will be smart contracts. But the third generation is something called decentralized identity, where you can take identity and trust and things and remove it from concentrators of
wealth.
What
is identity and trust? I'll explain what that means now.
So identity is the only way you can know who you are is by providing a credit card. Maybe,
correct.
Right? So if you don't have credit cards anymore, how do you know who you are? So there's an entire group of people figuring that out right now. It's called the distributed identity movement at the W3C, the World Wide Web Consortium.
Okay.
So these scientists are trying to figure that out now. When that happens, it will shift power back to individuals. So this is the takeaway is that the third generation will be good for humanity because there's something I call the job chasm. Whenever you have something like automobiles. When the horse and buggy business started getting decimated and the automobile business started growing, it took decades for gas stations to pop up, for auto repair shops to pop up. So the second wave, it will take a couple of years. If you look at the internet, a lot of people actually work on the internet, not just web designers and computer designers, but if you look at people teaching workshops, they're now online teaching it, and they use affiliate marketing to get listeners. So they're actually using this technology called autoresponders to kind of move an internet marketing revolution. So there's about $5 billion in marketing being done by people who are not technologists but leveraging that. So these new jobs will happen, but it will take time for that third generation to get in place so that we cross the job chasm. And a lot of new jobs will be created. But still, people have to... if you're driving a truck or a taxi, you're going to need to learn new services. Basically, I say that robots will replace roads and retail jobs, but blockchain will replace back office and business model jobs. So you actually have to look and be strategic about it because evolution is happening as we watch.
Last question. If I am somebody who is, let's say, half the population by definition is below average in drive, intelligence, emotional well-being, etc. Let's just say I'm at the 50th percentile. Uh-huh. I'm certainly not your sister. but I am a guy who went to San Francisco State. I majored in sociology. I'm not going to even say I'm old. I'm 35 or I'm 40. I'm that person. I am not driven. I'm not Mr. Technology. I major in sociology. I'm trying to take the prototypical KELW listener. I'm not even talking about, I'm not cherry picking at the bottom somebody who's, you know, a homeless living on the street or you know, who's a hotel toilet cleaner. I'm saying the average KELW listener. I'm 35 years old, and I say I'm majoring in sociology. I'm seeing all this automation. I'm seeing blockchain merely one of a zillion examples of where paid work that's sustainable, living wage work is going away. And I say to you, dear Moses, my brother, what do you tell me to do?
So I will tell you a little story. I did a strategic engagement with a large company, and they had just done an idea contest. And they noticed that everybody, you know, complied with submitting an idea, but the ideas weren't very good. And they said, why are our ideas not good? So they asked me to do an analysis. So I went and interviewed about 30 people in the company, and they brought in all the scientists and all the, you know, the CTO, and I said, great. I said, now send me some secretaries. Mm-hmm. So one of the admins came in, and I asked her, so did you participate? And she said, no. And I said, why? She says, well, you know, I'm very busy. I said, is there another reason? Like, for example, what was the prize for this idea contest? They gave away an iPad. I said, did you want an iPad? And she said, no, I already have one, so I didn't really want one. And I can't compete against the smart ones, so I'm not going to win, so why should I play? So I said to her, and this was in India, so I said, and they're very family-oriented, I said, suppose the prize wasn't an iPad, but was college education for free for one of your children. And she said, is that possible? And I said, that's what I'm recommending to the CEO, that if you actually make this big move, it would actually bring out true innovation. So she said, wow, that's an amazing concept. And I said, I'm going to record you, and I'll give you 5 minutes to come up with the best idea you've ever had in your life, and I'm going to play for the CEO. And then she broke into a sweat and said, first she said, I'm not smart enough, you know, and then she went, wait, I have an idea. And then she shared an idea that was actually really brilliant. And she said, is that a good idea? And I said, that's a great idea. That's actually like what somebody like the CTO would come up with. And she said, oh my God, I'm smart, you know? And that's the point here, is that regular people, you're actually really smart, that the human brain can come up with solutions if you apply yourself. But we actually kind of take the easy way out. So the number one thing I would tell everybody is to unlock your core creativity, figure out how to be creative, because creativity is the skill that will help you survive in the 21st century.
We could talk about this one for hours, but we're not doing so. Anyway, I'll thank you, Moses Ma, for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. What's one thing I always like to give my guests, one opportunity to plug something that you think you would like my listeners to know about?
So, yeah, come and read my blog. It's a Psychology Today, Moses Ma. It's called The Tao of Innovation.
T-A-O.
T-A-O of Innovation. And I'd say hi, subscribe, send me a note, and someday I'll write a book about that last topic, about unlocking your core creativity, and I'll let you know about it.
Anyway, thanks again for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you.
Be well. You can leave or you can sit around and watch the rest of the show. You can talk whatever's better for you. Anyway, but now, my dear listeners, we turned from the cutting edge to your edge. If you are struggling with your work life, whether you're 16 or 76, whether you're a techie or technophobic, as they say, always allowed to be technically unable, if you're whatever your station in life, as long as it's KLW, I'm likely to be able to help you. I do what I call workovers, no pummeling involved, usually. So, but if you would like a workover, I would be happy to help you try to solve your work malaise. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco and KLW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now, while I'm waiting for the calls to come in, I want to fulfill a twice broken promise. 2 weeks ago, I said that I was going to offer you a world's shortest course in negotiating your compensation. And I got through part of it, but again, I was busy with doing other things, so I never got through it. And then I promised again last week, and it also didn't happen. So I will try to do that now. But as always, I try to prioritize you, my dear listeners, so the callers. So we're going to go right to the phones. I guess it's not. Okay. So I'll just give out the phone number again. If you've got a work-related problem, 415-841-4134. Okay, back to negotiating your compensation. It's been said, for good reason, that negotiations are won or lost mainly before the negotiation itself. Preparation is key, but how? First of all, there is nothing that will help your confidence and your bargaining position like interest from another employer. Even if you intend to stay at your current organization, do put out some feelers. If you get any nibbles, you can legitimately tell your boss, "I'm happy here, but another organization has expressed interest in me." Now, telling your boss may risk alienating him, or her, of course, but even if you don't mention it, you're going to be more confident in negotiations. So getting some other interest is a great, great idea. I've got a lot more, but now let's go to the phones. Give it the phone number again one more time. If you have a work-related problem of any sort, try to stump me. Or come call because you're not trying to stump me because you're trying to get help. 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I had a pretty basic question. I'm in my mid-50s, and I'm basically looking to get out of the field that I've been in, which has been minor-level accounting. I'm thinking about getting into tech. I've taken a couple of HTML courses, mm-hmm. and like I said, I'm in my 50s. I'm just wondering if it's even worth it at my age to try to get into the tech field, because I know it's a younger person's field.
Yeah, statistically, you're right. You know, there are people who are digital natives who have been hacking and creating programs from when they were 13, and that's 10 years, and they're current. Now, HTML is your basic, that's the basic language used for website development. You know, now today, with so many websites, or, you know, there are templates that really don't require you even to know HTML. You know, we're in a world of, as the previous guest was talking about, was big data and data science. And these are advanced languages like R, and Python, and Ruby on Rails, and SQL. And I do worry. You know, I know that I'm supposed to, as this helper person, present optimism. We all need hope. But I don't think that's the smartest route to getting out. I believe, I've found over the years, that people in their 50s who are trying to make career change are more likely to be successful making a career pivot rather than a career rotation. So I know you want to get out of minor accounting. I'm assuming that kind of means bookkeeping. Is that correct?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to give you a couple of choices, and you tell me which, if you were forced to take one of these that are minor pivots, which would you choose? You would choose a particular vertical. Let's say you really care about nonprofits or the environment. You would focus on doing bookkeeping for small nonprofits. Or maybe it was that you want to improve your skills a little bit. Maybe you want to learn a little bit about forensic accounting, the art of, you know, where people are stealing, you know, one company or one nonprofit or one government agency is stealing data from another. If you had to choose either of those two, which would you choose?
I would say it's probably a nonprofit.
Okay. And are you currently self-employed or working for an entity?
I'm working for another entity.
Right. And would working for a nonprofit feel better, or would being self-employed feel better?
Probably working for a nonprofit. I've worked for a couple of nonprofits, and basically it's been the people there. It's been sort of personality issues, so I haven't totally written off working for a nonprofit, but so far my experience hasn't been that great with them.
Okay, so let's say there was something you needed to change about yourself. You know, let's say you have to change a couple of things: your attitude, your skill set, your political savvy, or the kind of nonprofit. It could be smaller, could be larger. You know, there's everything from the Catholic Church as a nonprofit to the Screw the White Males Foundation, you know, which is hegemonic today in the era of intersectionalism. What kind of nonprofit? What size nonprofit? What would you change about yourself?
I definitely need to upgrade my skill set. And I would probably work for something closer to the Screw the White Males nonprofit.
Oh, good for you. Self-immolation. I love it. Okay. So, because the risk is, you know, being presumptuous, you sound like a white male. So, so let's say, you know, a whole new skill set, that's too much. But let's say you were to take a baby step, and there was going to be a course on Lynda, you know, Lynda, LYNDA. It's the little short courses that are available on LinkedIn, or on Coursera, or Udemy, or Udacity, all of these little short, or you know, which, what's one baby steps short course you should take to up your game that would help you working for this nonprofit?
I am not sure, actually. I've been a little bit focused on sort of getting out of that, so I guess I haven't given it enough thought.
Well, you know, there are various. Would it be in auditing? Would it be in accounts payable? Would it be in tax? Would it be in tax? Would it be in learning a piece of software that's currently very popular in the nonprofit sector? Which of those feels like an area for growth that would actually you would actually not blow off and you'd actually do it?
I think it would have to be something like managerial accounting.
Man, great. So if I ask you to get off the phone for now, I'm not asking you to commit to anything here. I know you want to do something completely different. You probably want to be the starting forward for the Golden State Warriors, but that ain't going to happen tomorrow. So let's say that, you know, for an experiment, you were to get off the phone and you were to look at those websites I told you to find little short courses that have really great user reviews for managerial accounting. And then you were to think about the three nonprofits that you would most love to be a bookkeeper for. And then after you've gotten and think about the concept of taking this course and then reaching out to those nonprofits, either answering ads or simply reaching out to their CFO, whatever, you know, their director of accounting, and seeing if you can get at least a part-time job there. Ask yourself in your heart of hearts whether your life projected over the next 5 years is likely to be better if you are taking more computer programming classes and trying to buck that game, or better to do this pivot. How does that feel as an assignment for when we get off the phone right now?
It sounds like food for thought and a reasonable assignment. I guess my primary reason I was calling was I had had my sort of qualms about pursuing the tech field, and I just kind of wanted to get your advice on that.
Yeah, I must admit you've got the confirmation. Unless, you know, if you told me, Marty, you know, I'm taking this HTML course and boy, I got it so fast, I'm faster than any of the other students. It's like a duck to water. I can't wait to take my next course, but I didn't hear you say that. Am I right? It's not like you're a latent superstar that just was a late bloomer? Okay.
No, it's work.
Yeah. So, no, I would do that. And the other way to get something novel in your life is outside of work. You know, it may be that, you know, my wife, until she was in her 50s, did nothing regard to theater. She had no background in theater whatsoever. But then I pushed her butt to try out for this role that was like her natural personality. She got cast, and it is now this huge part of her life, even though she hasn't changed her career. So is there something outside of work, whether it be a romantic partner, a hobby, a volunteerism? You know, you say you want to screw the white male? Well, fine. Volunteer for the Screw the White Male Foundation. Is it possible that little tweaks of your career plus some kind of a more radical change where you're outside of work, where you're not relying on money, is the right combination for you?
That sounds utterly reasonable.
What would be the one thing you would do outside of work to give yourself juice that would get you motivated and excited about your overall life?
I am not sure. I'm still looking for that myself.
Oh,
actually,
Let me play with you here on the phone a little bit. So let's play. We're going to play a game called the optometry game. You ever go to the eye doctor and the eye doctor asks you, you know, he's trying to fit the right kind of contact lens or glasses, and he asks you, or she asks you, is it better with lens one or lens two? And then after a while, you can't tell and you feel stupid?
Right.
Okay. So I'm going to just give you two kind of things, and you just pick which one feels better. Would you rather meet a romantic partner or around volunteer for the Screw the White Male Foundation?
I'm pretty sure a romantic partner.
Romantic partner or take up a physical hobby, bicycling, yoga, you know, whatever.
I think I'd rather meet a romantic partner I can go bicycling with.
Okay. Oh, very nice. Okay. Would you rather meet a romantic partner by putting up a really awesome ad online or by or meeting, and how would you meet them? What would be the way in which you'd meet your Mr. or Ms. Wright?
Either by luck or probably by volunteering at the Screw the White Males Foundation.
Perfect. So if I said, fine, I'm not a big believer in luck. You know, I believe you make your own, to some extent, there's a lot of luck, but you got to do your part, which at least puts the odds in your favor. So, fine. So, fine, there are various Screw the White Male Foundations of various sorts. You know, minority advocacy groups, intersectionalism groups, whatever. Find the nonprofit. Do you know of any nonprofits that have that, you know, it's not part of my world. I think white males have contributed a great deal to society in our, you know, in our attempt to provide equal opportunity. I don't think we need to be so denigrating of white males, which is what the university is doing nonstop now. So, do you know of such an organization that you would like to check into?
I do know a couple.
What's name? I'm sure some of my listeners share those views. What are those? A couple of those organizations.
One is the Ella Baker. It was founded by Van Jones.
Okay. Right. Okay.
I think that's the main one that I know.
Good. So if we said, I want you to go to the website of Ella Baker, see what they, you know, learn about what they're currently doing, see where you might be able to add the most value to destroying white males, since you say that's the big deal you want to do, and then volunteer your services in that service, you know. Don't actually kill anybody. Just surf, work for Ella. If I said, you need to do that, you need to look for a course in managerial accounting, and find that romantic partner there at Ella Baker or whatever. How are you really feeling right now?
I feel that it's really, really practical advice. You know, basically, I just need to follow up on something like that.
And if we were in Las Vegas, and what were the odds a week from now, if we had, could bet whether you would or would not follow through on this, should we bet that you would or you wouldn't?
I think the odds are like 60-40 that I would.
Now, why isn't it? You say you want to improve your life. You say it's a very practical plan. It meets not my. This is not my plan, obviously. I was the last thing in the world I'd ever do. But you're saying it's your plan. Why would you want to be so self-immolating, to use that term again, to not follow through on that plan, since it's what you want?
I guess I just know my past history or whatever, you know?
Well, so, you know, you're not dead yet, so, and you're not consigned, so you're not ball and chain to your past. You're not a marionette who's got fishing line holding you back to your past. Why, and you're saying, damn it, this Marty Nemco guy is pushing my butt, and, you know, that you know, now is the time to act. What makes you, why not, you know, your motivation is never going to be greater than the moment you get off this phone. Why wouldn't you say, okay, I don't want to consign myself to a life of previous failures and previous lack of following through. What would keep you from getting off the phone right now and getting on, right on this?
The Indy 500 is on right now. That was a joke.
Okay.
I guess basic laziness, you know. I mean, it's easy, I guess, to, in theory, do these things, from my experience. And I just haven't followed through on a lot of them.
Yeah, the shrinks would say there's no lazy people. The shrinks say it's all fear of failure, fear of rejection, fear of success, fear of the man, or not wanting to capitulate to the man. Would you say that you're really lazy at the core, or is it these psychologist-designed fears?
I think I'm pretty lazy.
Okay. Are you doing too many drugs? That's often, we all know that marijuana reduces motivation. Are you smoking too much dope and other drugs?
I've passed that phase already.
Okay. So objects at rest tend to stay at rest. Objects in motion tend to stay in motion. What should you do? I'm not saying you're going to be super Mr. Driven, super crazy hyper, but what baby step could you take so that you, right now you're kind of describing yourself as a slug, you don't really follow through, even though it's a great plan. What could you do to move the odds from 60-40 that you'll execute to, say, 70-30. Let's not go wild here. What could you do to move, to start your inert object moving?
I think, first of all, things would have to get worse for me. Second of all, I think part of what I'd have to do is, while I'm going to volunteer, is actually doing the bicycling thing, too. Those would actually be sort of symbiotic or synergistic.
I really like that. And, you know, you would do me and our listeners an enormous favor if next week you call back and give an honest, no BS report on what you've done, not done, etc. And, you know, your life can't help but benefit, and at minimum, you'll be benefiting. You had the motivation to call the show today. Get your butt on the phone next week and call back. What do you think?
I think I'll do that.
Well, what would the odds be? If we're in Vegas, what are the odds that you're going to call back next week, dude?
I would say 70-30.
Shoot, I would say with a different letter than shoot, but I want you to call back. All right, I'm letting you off the phone. Have a good Sunday.
Okay. All right, take it easy.
We got plenty of calls on the line, but I promise I don't want to keep breaking my promises. So a little more about this negotiating compensation, then we'll go back to the phones. It's very helpful. We're going to go back to the phones in just a moment. So another way to really prepare well for preparing for asking for a raise is to know the risk reduction techniques. There are a lot of people who are afraid that if they ask for a raise, they're going to get a response like, Well, you know, you're already too expensive. I think we need to let you go. Well, you can counter such fears by knowing ways to reduce the risk. First of all, use a positive tone. Prepare to use a positive tone, like, you know, I'm confident we'll come up with something that we'll both feel good about. That's less likely to engender a negative response where they want to get rid of you. Another way to reduce the chances of their letting you go or hurting you in this negotiation, try to get the employer to make the first offer and listen carefully for cues that the offer is final. And if you're not sure, a low-risk way to assess that is, how firm is the offer? You're not playing hardball here, so it reduces the fears. And the third way, you can counter the fear of the risk that they're going to let you go or think worse of you for asking for raises. Use this rule of thumb. Plan to reject the first offer, but accept the second. Anything you might get beyond the second offer is usually too little to justify the risk. One more thing before I go to the phones. Before you go and ask for a raise, log your contributions. Keep an email file, you know, Microsoft Word file or whatever, of like where you did save your organization money, or you boosted sales, or in the nonprofit sector, boosted donations. Because it's all about, you're asking for more money. Where did you save money? Where did you bring more money in? Have you decreased the hassle or stress on a project? Write that down. Like streamline some procedure or whatever. Write down if you showed some leadership under pressure. Maybe there was, you know, there was an insurrection among the workers and you showed ethical but firm, wise leadership. Write that down. If you, let's say you went above and beyond. You worked longer, harder, did some extra research on a project and it was of value. Write that down. Did you recently upgrade your job responsibilities? Even though your job title hasn't changed, have you taken on more? Write that down. Have you recently completed a course on Udemy, on Udacity, on Lynda, or a certificate program, or certainly a degree? Write that down. So now you've got ammunition. You've got the basis for legitimating your pay raise. Right? One more. I want to make sure that I get through enough of this before I go back to the phones. Try to get comparable salary information. Try at least to ask your coworkers inside your organization, maybe colleagues outside of it, maybe your friends, your alumni, your LinkedIn connections, for what they're making, and then check out the salary surveys on Glassdoor.com or Salary.com or PayScale. You want to create a list of comparable salaries and adjust them, of course, to fit your situation. Do it on one page, because this is going to show this to the employer. And at the bottom of the page, say what you think is fair in light of the comparables. Or you can try, and you know, you can maybe to be a little more aggressive, try to justify 10 to 15% above fair, because your boss is going to need to feel they got a win. Everybody wants to feel they got a win in a negotiation. So making your request a bit high allows your boss to feel he or she's getting a good deal and offering you a little bit less, and you're still getting more than you otherwise would have gotten. Another example. Try to propose an upgraded job description, even if your job title remains the same. Because higher level work is going to justify higher level compensation. Like, might you offer to supervise more people or write a grant proposal? Right? One more thing. A couple more things. No, boy, time is running out. Damn. Okay, one more. Really try to get clear on your negotiation's highest realistic goal, your expected goal, and the least you'd accept. It's really important to walk in with that. And don't, this is really important, don't focus just on cash compensation, because that, unlike benefits and perks, are taxed. And indeed, they're taxed at your highest rate. We have a progressive income tax, so the additional amounts can be taxed at your highest rate. It also gives the employer nothing in exchange. When you're getting cash, he gets nothing. Instead, you want to prioritize, in general, non-cash items that are not taxable and that may benefit your employer, like a job description tweaked to accentuate your strengths or simply be more fun. Maybe whom you report to. Doesn't cost anybody anything. You may get to report to a boss you'd much rather work for. A title change. That can be a good leverage for future jobs in your career. Part-time telecommuting. The traffic is bizarre and mass transit still takes forever. So if you can work at home 1 or 2 days a week, you've saved a ton of time, gas, and stress. Flex time. Instead of 9 to 5, coming in at 7 to 3, that might benefit the employer. It might benefit you. Fully employer-paid health care. Yeah, the employer doesn't benefit from that, but that's a not tax benefit. nice benefit, or deferred compensation like stock options, or tuition reimbursement. The employer benefits from that and you benefit, or some other kind of training, going to that conference in Hawaii, for example, or vacation days. Now, again, that one, the benefit, the employer doesn't benefit. It's another, you know, it's anyways. But those are some examples. And one more thing about that. It's dangerous to try to negotiate too many items. And, of course, every situation is different. But a rule of thumb, negotiate salary plus two or three items. Okay, I've just a couple minutes. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hi. Are you there? Let's go to the next line. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hello?
Hello.
Are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Oh, okay. I can, yeah.
Awesome.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, perfectly.
Okay. So, Marty, okay, here's the thing. What is the deal with this screw the white man hobby horse you're on?
Oh.
I know you get on these things once in a while, and I sometimes think, oh, he's finally losing it. But what is this all about? And when you do that fake black voice, you sound really racist, and I know you don't mean to.
Okay, it's a good question.
What's going on?
I've been studying of late what's going on at universities, and
I know, but you've said this so many times about how, you know, I've been listening to you for a while, and you've said a number of times how, you know, people aren't tenured, and university jobs are just ripping off the employee.
Okay. Because of the time, I'm going to thank you for
it's
the call.
Crazy.
I'm going to thank you for the call. So here's what's going on. I am at ultimate as a career counselor, but it's as a human being. I'm very concerned about merit. I am offended. You know, she uses the term race. The term racism gets thrown around all the time. I'd be as concerned, for example, if an African American is not getting hired for a position when he or she is at least as qualified or more qualified. But what I'm seeing at the university is this massive shouting down of speakers who are white males, who are not talking, who are not in favor of intersectionalism, which is the dominant hegemonic view on college campuses today. So I'm aware of that being a serious problem. You know, I was really offended, of course, when, you know, by McCarthyism's taking very anti-communist views, when I believe there's views that the left, as you could have said in the earlier part of the show, there's good argument that capitalism is got serious, serious problems. But now, that very same and frankly more ruthless and more vicious censorship where they're not allowing people to speak who are... You know, there are colleges who are saying we want white males to not show up for a day, so to give a safe space for people. And there was this biology professor, I think it was at Evergreen State, this was this week, who said he was going to show up. And they massively protested, they massively yelled, they called them names, etc. You know, I've been a big consumer of education. I have a PhD from Berkeley. And I feel like that's got to be the place where we should be able, if any place, we should share ideas. And I'm very concerned about a place that's being as reactionary, ironically, from the left, as McCarthyism was from the right at one of our most hallowed institutions. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Colin Peden, and all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I'll be talking with Robert Greenberg. He's probably the subject that's the most boring in the world, musicology, and he makes it interesting. We're going to talk about what it's really like to be a pro musician and all the fights and things that go on between musicians and conductors and like. Anyway, until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.